This is an edit of an interview I just did with the author William Ramsey. I don't normally do my own edits and post versions of interviews that are done with me, but in this case, Bill and I went sort of around the houses a little bit in the second hour, and I wanted just to put all the material that focused on John DeRuta into one audio, and this is it. I will also link to the full two-hour interview once Bill puts it up. Thanks to Bill Ramsey for this opportunity.
When all the little kings and queens have squandered and destroyed this place, we'll sing into the setting sun has lit a fire upon our face.
All right, 3, 2, 1. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On tonight's show, I have a very special guest. His name is Jason Horsley. I had a discussion with him on his podcast, which is located at, you can see a reference to it or a link to it at autoculture.com. That's his website. And his podcast is titled The Liminalist, the podcast between. A really interesting podcast, very cool guest. I think I was, when I was interviewed, the guy who was before me was the lead actor on Stephen King's book about, what was the name of that book? What was the name of that movie with the
Christine?
Car?
Yeah, Christine. Keith Gordon, yeah.
Yeah, so Keith Gordon. So, but Jason Horsley is from the UK. He's an excellent writer. I just finished reading his book, The Dark Oasis, A Self-Made Messiah Unveiled. That's the book we're going to be discussing today. He's also written other books, Homo Serpians, Secret History of DNA from Eden to Armageddon, The Lucid View, Investigations in Occultism, Ufology, and Paranoid Awareness. That was published in 2004. He has two books coming up. One is about UFO social engineering and the psychology of fragmentation. That's called, titled The Prisoner of Infinity. And another is The Vice of Kings, Occultism, Social Control, and Abuse Control. That'll also be out next year. So I look forward to reading those. But I just finished his book, Dark Oasis, yesterday. So we'll talk about that. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thanks, William.
Awesome. Really enjoyed the book. Very interesting analysis and insight into this character by the name of John DeRuiter, DeRuiter, and his kind of headquarters was in Edmonton in Canada.
Still is.
And he called it the Oasis, that's the name of the title, Dark Oasis. But Jason has a very interesting tale to tell about his encounter, when he first met John DeRuiter, and everything that kind of up until today, very recently in 2017. And this book has been a book he's been working on for some time, 7 years, it seems like, or maybe 5 years, but he can talk more about that. Jason, before we get into talking about John DeRuiter, tell a little bit about yourself, if you can.
Oh, that's always the most difficult question. I always just think of the present right off. I work in a thrift store, run a thrift store in Canada, have a pretty regular life at present, married with a cat, pretty content, which I'd say for the first time in my life I can say without, you know, doubting myself. Prior to that, I mean, the life that's led me to this point is, as you know, I think, William, a pretty unusual one of spiritual seeking, gallivanting. I've traveled the world from the age of 17 to about the age of 40 when I started finally to slow down and actually put some roots down. I was always looking for an answer. Now I'm thinking of The Matrix, I can't help it, I wrote a book about that too. Like a splinter in my brain, it felt, was always driving me to try and discover what was wrong, essentially, with myself or with reality or both. And that led me on, I would say, some down some dead ends, let's say. So I got into Carlos Castaneda and Crowley and occultism, as you and I talked about last time we spoke, and into shamanism in general, and a lot of psychedelic use. I would have got into a lot of sexual promiscuity if I'd been able to, but I was never very successful in that area. But basically, what is conventionally known as the left-hand path, I was driven to kind of seek self-transformation through through Will, through the appliance of Will, and trying to explore all of these different, not just occult, but philosophical and esoteric paths. And that...
You wrote, even in this book, you wrote you were in contact with Kenneth Grant,
yeah.
who actually sat... basically live with Crowley right there at the end in Hastings. I found that pretty interesting that you were in conversation with him.
Yeah, I know. It is. It is interesting. I mean, obviously it was exciting at the time, and I just thought, yay, this confirms my feeling that I'm somehow especially endowed, you know, and I'm able to make connections that confirm this feeling I had that my destiny was, even at, there was a point in my life where I thought my destiny was in the book of the law, you know, it says one will come after and solve this riddle, right. And I thought, that's me, and, you know, I really heavily invested in that whole thing, so connecting with Kenneth Grant seemed like a confirmation of that, and...
Hubbard thought he was the one who'd come after, too, so you weren't the only one who wished for that attainment.
That's right. There were obviously thousands of them.
You're right, exactly.
And Hubbard would be much closer to actually.
Well, yeah. You're not that far off. If you were in contact with Kenneth Grant, you're only about 3 degrees of separation from Crowley himself.
Well, that makes it pretty scary, doesn't it? Especially if people do guilt by association conspiracy theory, because, you know.
We won't apply that to you. We will not apply that to you. Although I'd love to know what you guys wrote about, what you...
Oh, I put all the letters online.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I'll send you the link. I took scans from them and I shared them a couple of years ago.
Awesome.
But anyway, just to finish my story and hopefully kind of contextualize what we're talking about here with Grant and all that. In the last few years, congruent with getting married and also the period described in Dark Oasis, I guess you could say I came down to earth. I crash landed, really. I'd crash landed before that, so... It was after I crash landed from too much occultism and too many psychedelics that I met my wife and John DeRusha and also Dave O'Shana, who's another spiritual teacher of a much very different caliber, and that all of this combined sort of coming down to earth led into my investigations into my own family history, which is what Vice of Kings is about. Well, it's partly about that and partly about Crowley. I have two parts to the book. And the discovery that that somehow I'd been indoctrinated or conditioned to identify with these occult narratives and with this path, and that was inseparable from a kind of early trauma, even possibly relating to sexual abuse, or almost certainly, but possibly relating to organized rings of sexual abuse, as are quite well documented or quite exposed now in Britain, not to
right.
the extent that anything's changed, I don't think, but certainly what I was able to uncover by looking back over my own personal history and British history using Jimmy Savile as a kind of a microchipped eel, you know, follow that guy
right,
and see which holes he goes into.
Oh, and there's so many, it's uncountable, right?
Yeah, yeah, and how many times that led to tunnels, if you will, that my family also moved down, and also Crowley. Like I mentioned the 3 degrees of separation from Crowley. Well, I found quite a few exactly that, 2 or 3 degrees of separation between family members, mostly my brother and my grandfather, and Crowley. Obviously, he'd died, you know, 20 years before I was born, but my grandfather had a very close, well, a close friend who lived in Hastings where Crowley died, so and did talks there, so it's quite likely possible that my grandfather visited there and that he did know Crowley. I mean, you know, whatever Peter Lavender says, so what? But to me, it's definitely, it obviously doesn't prove anything, and it's not really significant in and of itself, but just as a sort of concrete indication of how close my own family circle came to overlapping with Crowley's, and by extension those of occultism, intelligence networks and organized child abuse, which I feel are more or less the same. The same.
Like it seems running the same. I mean, it's especially here in the States with this whole Pizzagate, all those people are politicians, child abusers, connections to intelligence, legal environment, you know, so.
Yeah.
But incidentally to the listener, talking about bringing up Lavenda, Jason put an excellent post recently on his Ought Culture website. Go check that out about Lavenda. Lavenda talking on Coast to Coast under a different kind of using a different voice. Really interesting stuff. And you, one of your first interviews on your podcast, or the first two, I think, were with Peter Lavenda, if I remember correctly.
On The Limbalist, and also prior to that, and Stormy Weather, it was when I was under the cloak of Aeolus Cephas, yeah.
Gotcha, cool. So you've come quite a bit away, all the way from northern England to Vancouver, Canada, and at some point, I think it was in the south of England where you ran into John DeRuiter, is that correct?
Well, let me think. No, because I first met him in London. Heard about him through the woman that became my wife, because she knew him. And then I looked into him, and I was curious. I had this massive dream encounter, or whatever we're going to call that. It was some sort of vision that convinced me that he was a powerful sorcerer of some kind. As it turned out, he was coming to London right at a point I was just about to leave to go to Canada. I even had to change my flight, I think, to meet him, and I did that, and then I went and I met him in London. If you can say meet, you know, he was on stage. I had a dialogue with him as one of the, you know, the spiritual seekers there at his feet. And I was that impressed that I went back the next day with my sister and a close friend, Mark Lorne, because I wanted them to see him. And that time I didn't speak to him, and I just sat and tuned into him.
And what was your first impression when you saw him face to face? Can you describe him or the impact he had upon you?
Okay, so if we rule out the dream, because we can't really be sure how real that was, then the first physical encounter was, it was a sort of slow first impression, because my very first impression was, I noticed how slowly he moved, his kind of robotic movements. I noticed how much power he seemed to emanate on the stage, just in terms of his stillness. But I was definitely skeptical, hearing him talk to the person that went before me. He speaks in a very vague, very slow, very spaced out way, and kind of simplistic, even simple-minded, some of the phrases. And so I was having a lot of skeptical thoughts, which I suppressed, because I figured, well, just wait until he speaks to me and see how that is. And then the first thing he said to me was, referred to the inner child, and I had actually been exploring this concept of the inner child and trying to connect to my own childhood. So it directly referenced something that I, you know, was heavy on my mind, you might say. And so you could say he hooked me at that point. Like he really got my attention. I thought, okay, he's definitely not just doing a one size fits all thing here. He seems to have tuned into something deep in myself, and he's responding to that. And my overall impression was that the words that he spoke didn't matter that much, and that he was communicating energetically with my body.
Interesting.
Body to body, and bypassing my intellect, which I thought was, that seemed valid to me, because I'd come to believe that my intellect was kind of a damaged tool and a shield that kind of buffered me from an experience with reality, rather than a really valid way to understand or apprehend reality. So basically that helped persuade me that the guy was for real.
And was the environment that you were in, was he sitting there with the same glass of water, mm-hmm. the flowers, mm-hmm. the chair, and then everybody kind of faced him mm-hmm. and maybe semicircle with the women sitting on their knees in front, maybe?
There wasn't any semicircle, there wasn't any women on the floor, I think it was just chairs lined up in rows.
Very standard. I mean, he seems to be a taller person, piercing blue eyes. When I first saw a picture of him, it reminded me of, and I don't even know why, but it reminded me of like what people draw of like Nordic UFOs, like the memory of that. For some reason, he almost has that look. I think he's from Danish extraction, right? Dutch, like his story, yeah. Dutch. Yeah, Dutch. So he's Dutch in his family. He was a cobbler in Edmonton before he got started with all this. So trace what happened after your first meeting and how you became drawn into his place that he calls the Oasis in Edmonton, and how you got drawn into him and that mm-hmm. story.
Okay, so as I say, I went back the next day, and I was very, you know, right from the start. Another first impression I had was what was around John, the Oasis organization. I didn't like that. For example, I asked if I'd be able to get a recording of my dialogue with John, and they said no. They were selling things, and it just felt kind of very corporate. Not very corporate, but too corporate for somebody who seemed to be, you know, claiming to be surrendered in an exclusively spiritual place. The whole Oasis thing around him felt somehow suspect. So that was part of my impression. And as well as that, my impression of the people who came to see John was not very positive. And on the second day, it was particularly acute because there were a bunch of questions, people asking him really asinine questions, or not really even asking, just talking and talking, and obviously trying to hold his attention. And, you know, it just felt, the whole thing felt a bit nauseating to me. I mean, I've always been very anti-New Age and gurus and all of that thing. I was always just inherently or temperamentally opposed to that. So what I did on the second day was to try and deal with the asinine questions and my feelings of distaste for all of that. I just tried to tune into John, and I wasn't opposite him, but I was in the front row, and I sat without moving, just gazing at him for must have been an hour or more, and even not blinking, because he doesn't blink, he doesn't move, he doesn't blink. You know, when he speaks, it takes him 2 minutes to even start to move his lips. It's a very strange thing. Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of a common theme in your book, is the silence, the spaces between words that you defined his character, how he used his silence.
Yes, and stillness. And I didn't think about it at the time, but I'd done acting class, and one of the exercises in acting class is about status and how you project status, and one of the ways is stillness. Like if you move your head around a lot when you talk, that's low status, that signals low status. If you maintain stillness, that's high status. So there was something about John that I was receiving unconsciously, and I wasn't analyzing intellectually, but his whole way of appearing, can't say being because I'm not sure what's going on the inside, was manifesting or projecting the idea of power and creating the corresponding reverence, because people feel reverence for power, you know. So I wanted to kind of tune into or align myself with John, just try and really put all my attention on him, so I didn't have to get distracted by everything going on around him. And so I kept completely still, and as I say, I hardly even blinked. And at the end of that experience, I felt very different in my body. Like I felt like all this power coursing through my body. I also felt lighter than usual, almost like I could float. It just felt as though I'd entered into this different physical state just by tuning into him. And based on that, I decided, I must be getting a taste of what it feels like to be John. Like he's in this completely different state of consciousness. And that's what I want. Yeah.
Right.
So I want to be like this guy.
Right. So you know, he made an impression upon you in that, just to, like, this is a quote from your book. This is John DeRuiter talking, just to give the audience an idea of how the language kind of comes out of him when he's talking. He says, "You can be what you know the truth of within or as awareness. You can lie to knowledge and fool yourself. Either way, you will be paying a great price. Cost is constant. The cost will be to yourself, or it will be to your own core, depending on the way you choose." So I've listened to some of his audio and video, and it sounds a lot like that, this kind of new age, kind of self-help, self-awareness kind of talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so after you kind of were drawn into John DeRuiter and the Oasis, and what was the name of his? It was the Center for
College of Integrated Philosophy.
College of Integrated Philosophy. So then, what were the next steps you took to kind of get more involved in the kind of environment that he had?
Well, I moved to Canada after that because that's where my wife was.
This is like 2010, 2009, is that right?
This was 2008.
2008, okay.
The end of 2008. So I had this dream encounter with John, and then I had the real life encounter, and that had pretty much sold me that this guy was for real. The other impression I had that I took about in the book was that he was very yin, like he was this very feminine presence, and I wondered where the yang energy was, you know, where the masculine energy, and I also saw that in archetypal terms of, like, he was obviously manifesting a kind of Christ-like presence, this gentle, compassionate, wise, you know, God-like presence. But because I was into occultism, I identified much more with Lucifer as an archetypal. I saw them as two sides of the same archetype. So I wondered, you know, where's the Lucifer? Where's that yang, sexual, masculine, Luciferian energy? Is it hiding, or does he not have it? And so that, in retrospect, that question was the question that I ended up answering with Dark Oasis, and that actually, you know, it's all coming to light. Where is that side? Well, it's behind the scenes, where you would expect it to be, right?
Right.
You know, it's the hidden side of this guy. Anyway, that was sort of a...
How did you discover that kind of what you describe as the yang energy or the yang element to his character? How did that unfold to yourself?
Well, it was a long process. It was a long process, and it was... I mean, I didn't... I'm not sure if I could say if I've ever seen it directly, because he does work hard to conceal it, or he did. I mean, even at this point, he's still concealing it insofar as, although he's acknowledging having sex with his followers and having had sex secretly with his followers and married women and so on for decades, he's not doing it on stage. He's still not showing that particular side of his personality or his character. He's acknowledging it and he's admitting to it, but he's still in this very gentle, calm, wise, seemingly loving.
Right, but according to your book, he promoted abstinency and promoted, you know, mm-hmm. Loyalty to yourself. So he's saying that publicly, and behind the scenes, he's not adhering to that at all. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, that's the main thing. That's been the main theme throughout my investigations into this guy, is the discrepancy between what he preaches and what he practices. So he didn't actually preach celibacy, but he did preach... a kind of abstinency. I mean, certainly he preached no sex before marriage, certainly he preached monogamy, and he even preached that married couples should abstain from sex for sustained periods of time and only have sex if it was a movement of being, you know, not be having sex just for emotional or physical satisfaction. So he definitely had a very high standard which he was, right. I would say, imposing on his followers,
like an asceticism, maybe, you know, like this kind of monkish detraction from the flesh, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, on the other hand, he one of the appeals he had for people early on, I think, because he started out as this small kind of redneck guy in Edmonton, Alberta. He was a Christian, but that's not mutually exclusive with rednecks. So you could say he was a kind of redneck sort of guy, a trucker and an outdoor guy and a real simple guy who liked Louis L'Amour Western novels. And he drank beer and he smoked cigarettes. And so initially, like, part of his appeal was that he wasn't at all New Age and he wasn't at all aesthetic. Like he did these kind of things that are considered unhealthy or impure within the usual spiritual mindset. But he was also Christian, so you could say that's similar to Christians. Like, Christians are quite tend to be quite I don't know what you want, what word you could use, not necessarily puritanical, but conventional about sex in terms of monogamy and stuff. But they smoke and they drink because that's considered all right, right? So his moral set was more Christian than spiritual or New Age.
Right, and that's an interesting point, because when I first came across DeRuiter, my first impression was, this is a New Ager, you know, capital N, capital A Ager. And then when I read your book, like, he started out as a Christian, as a Lutheran, and, you know, giving sermons that apparently he wasn't very good at. But it's surprising for me that he came out of, you know, you've mentioned Finney and somebody else, what some of these
Andrew Murray,
19th century preachers. Yeah. And I like, when he talks, I don't see any of that. I see that there's something of a Christian ethos in his talks, but I wouldn't say he's referencing Christianity. So he definitely made a move from as a Christian. I mean, that's what his first wife, I mean, we can talk about his relationship with women, but that's what she said, is he moved from there to some other kind of New Age position.
Yeah, he's been reformatting his methods and his teachings in order to maximize their appeal. So at a certain point he went from, because his first core group were Christian apostates, like they were Lutherans, and John tried to gain power within the church, the Bethlehem church that he was part of, and he ended up getting kicked out, and so various other members of that church went with him, and that became the original circle. And then John figured out that he could, by the tradition of tithing, he didn't have to work anymore. He could just get his apostles or disciples or whatever he thought of them as at that time to give him 10% of their earnings, and then he'd become, you know, he was the main preacher of this new splinter group.
It was never determined how he got kicked out of that original congregation, correct?
No, it's pretty unclear, and even Joyce's first wife didn't know that he was kicked out until I went and talked to those people. She always believed his version, which was that he'd left.
That's amazing. So he had kept her deceived for 2 decades, right?
Well, if that's the case, if he was kicked out, and I think it is, and even if it isn't, he certainly deceived her for decades, because we know it's now come out that he was having sex with one of her close friends, you know, way back in those days.
All right, and so you've been in contact with his ex-wife, correct?
Yeah, that was my first real source when I started writing the book, like, because she wanted to write a book of her own, and so she was pleased to hear that somebody was writing a book, and she was very willing to talk to me. And yeah, without her, I wouldn't really have been able to find out very much about DeRuiter at all, because most people close to him don't want to talk about him at all. They're either, you know, blindly loyal to him and also afraid of, you know, getting his disfavor, or they're, I would say, been so negatively impacted by him that they just don't want to think about him at all, and or they're also afraid of repercussions.
Gotcha. And maybe that's a good other thing to talk about as far as the audience is concerned, is the organization around DeRuiter, how he's built it up and what it currently is and how much he's worth, how much money he brings in, etc.
Yeah, because that's what, I mean, that's, as you know, you read the book, it's one of the questions that I kept bumping into was, how much did this empire, which back in 2010 was valued at 5.5 million, I don't know what the value of it is now, this spiritual empire that's Oasis, that formed around John, how much was it the result of his conscious intention and planning, and how much did it just sort of happen? And that latter interpretation may seem naive to most people, but that's the general view of John among his followers, and it was my view, as I say, from the start, when I saw right away, I intuited that something was wrong with the Oasis organization around him. I rationalized it right away by telling myself, well, John, if he's really completely surrendered to truth, if he's a living embodiment of truth, as he claims, then he just goes along, you know, with everything that's happening, and if people want to build him up into this, and if they want to create this organization around him, and if they want to dress him in nice suits, and because I'd heard that his wives dressed him and did his hair and everything. I had this idea of him like a baby, like he was just completely passive. He was just there emanating pure goodness while all the people around him sort of shaped the empire and built the empire around him, and he didn't do anything about it because he surrendered, right? In fact, the truth is that, and I started to find this out pretty quickly, that behind the scenes, John is very far from a surrendered type. Like, he had security cameras in his house, he had Rottweilers, he's likes to kind of fiddle the books on accounting, say allegedly there, don't want to get sued. Very, very tight-fisted, very vindictive about bad publicity, like works very hard to stop any bad publicity about him or make threats, legal threats, controls any use of his image, so very, very controlling, in fact.
Right. There's been another, there was like a journalist who did an article about him, I think in 2010, does that sound right, in Canada, talking about him, and DeRuiter or his attorneys tried to keep that from being published. Does that sound right?
I don't know about the date, but certainly that. I think there was a Brian Hutchinson was one specifically. That sounds right. That would have probably been earlier. I think most of the bad press was after he split with Joyce, which, gotcha. And we have to remember, because your listeners won't know anything about any of this, so we have to kind of hit the main points, I suppose. And the main scandal around DeRuiter until recently was when he split with his wife, which was a result of him clandestinely taking on two of his followers as lovers, the Von Sass sisters. And he did this in such a way that he lied about it for a period of time to his wife, and then at a certain point when he gauged that she was ready for the truth, he told her. But in such a way that he made it seem that he hadn't been lying previously, that it was a kind of constantly changing story, actually. But one of his methods for covering up the deception was by saying that what had happened wasn't what it looked like on the surface, and though it looked like him cheating on his wife or committing adultery, in fact it had been a movement of being on the deeper planes, and the sexual desire had nothing to do with it. So when his wife asked him, you know, was he having sex with the sisters, he'd said no, because she was talking on this mundane level of just sexual lust and adultery, whereas what had happened was on this deeper level of a movement of spiritual being. You know, right. I have to laugh now, but I actually bought that. You know, I bought that explanation.
A lot of people did. I mean, a lot of his followers did. Have you ever heard of Joseph Smith's scam, how he would have sex with his followers' wives? What he did was he made this thing about a celestial marriage. So his followers would have a terrestrial marriage. Then he would celestially marry these women. So then he would have his way with them and then send them back to their husband. So right. He had kind of a new spiritual, you know, twist on these things that people believed in. You know, they don't even know how many people Joseph Smith. It's probably the same with DeRuiter. What you know in the public isn't the entirety of the story of how many people he's had. How many of his followers he's had relations with, you know, it's unknown, right?
Yeah, it's completely unknown. I don't think anyone knows except possibly his son and obviously John himself.
Right. I mean, he has three kids from his first wife. He had the two Von Sass sisters, and then there were other people's, and then there was a tragic death. This woman by the name of Anina, she disappeared in 2015. Was found naked at the bottom of a cliff or something like that. So
in a forest, yeah. She died of hypothermia, and it was ruled a suicide or accident. Even the ruling isn't clear. It was basically the case was closed, unsolved, but obviously it was ruled not foul play. She was a follower of John for some years.
And she was very, she wasn't very active with other men, and they found in her diary stories that she was having, you know, sexual relationships with DeRuiter. At least that's the way they interpreted the writings.
Yes, that's right. And then again, John claimed that Anina was just writing about visions,
And convenient explanation, right?
Yes, I mean it's that's essentially what appears to be going on with John, and one of the things that makes it such an interesting and useful case study, I think, is the use of spiritual language and spiritual principles even to rationalize and justify and conceal predatorial behaviors, really.
Right. Well said. Very well said. And there was something strange, too. Like, he called her family, or they talked right 2 days after she disappeared before her body was found, and said something criminal was happening with her disappearance. But I don't know how he would know that or even state that. And the family, you know, I don't think is satisfied with the police decision, if I remember correctly.
No, they're definitely not. And it does remain a mystery. It's true. The whole thing does, really. I mean, I don't know how you felt after when you got to the end of the book, whether you felt like, you know, the mystery was solved, because I really can't reach any conclusion about John DeRusso and Oasis beside that people are being hurt.
Messages in shadows hid. Don't waste away your wind. You were only born to follow. Horizon, I do hide the wind. Who rings the bells of happiness? Whose one invention is the end? Whose we His messages in shadows here. Don't waste away your wind. You were only born to follow.
Yeah, I mean, you make that point over and over that there's so many people that have come into his orbit and left more pained than they were when they went in, you know, more damage, more hurt.
Yeah.
I think that you, and you've talked to many of the former followers, current followers through Facebook, through email, stuff like that, even this year.
To currently, I mean, it's still ongoing. Obviously, now the book's come out. There may be some fallout from that, hopefully good, but there could also be negative. I mean, I could end up receiving a letter from DeRusso's lawyers. That's a possibility.
And other people have received letters. There was a slap lawsuit, if I remember, you mentioned that. And you just published the book this month, right? November 11th, 2017.
Yeah.
So recently. Although you've been working on it for 5-7 years or something.
7 years, yeah, which is unusual for me to work that long on a book. And part of it, as I write in the book, was just not feeling sure that it was a good idea to publish it, because, as I say, of not being clear about what John was doing. The thing is that a big part of the reason that I believed John and took on board his explanations and his interpretations and his spiritual, you know, instructions and all that was because a lot of them coincided with things I'd already come to believe, without going into the specifics. But he definitely appealed to a certain sort of ideological framework that I'd already adopted, a combination of Crowley, Castaneda, New Age, you know, spirituality in general. What was I going to say there?
Would you say that's the same with a lot of his followers, that they're in that kind of maybe alternate New Age, Crowley, Castaneda, you know, sensibility, and so coming along to Deruder was, you know, an easy step for them?
Well, one could do an interesting survey in terms of John's followers, because there's a bunch of sannyasins, you know, the ex-Osho followers that
Rajneesh, what was his name, Rajneesh?
Bhagwan
Rajneesh.
Rajneesh,
Osho,
yeah. John went to India several times to, you know, recruit, let's say, followers of Osho. He goes to Israel regularly. He's constantly recruiting. He's trying to build up his audience cult.
Traveling. So he's going to the States, Canada, Israel, UK. Where else was he on? Maybe France? I don't remember. Definitely Denmark, right?
Holland is one of his regular stops. He probably goes to Germany because there's a lot of Germans. He didn't used to be able to go to the US, actually. He was banned as a cult leader, interestingly. But he went last year, so somehow he's managed to lift that embargo, which is interesting. I'm not sure how he managed that.
What do you think is what's interesting about the book is how many people want to move from all over the world to go to Edmonton to be by him. How big do you think that the people living in that oasis is? How many followers do you think he has nearby?
It's always quoted as between 300 and 400, which obviously is, you know, a pretty broad spectrum there. So, you know, it can vacillate or whatever, oscillate is the word. Between that 300 and 400, I think it was bigger. I think after a lot of people did leave after Joyce. People have left as a result of Anina, and I'm sure people are leaving now as a result of the calling. But then he's constantly replenishing. And to get back to, because we didn't finish the earlier point about what kind of people follow John. And these are probably the people that would contact me, so I would become more aware of it, but there are people who are interested in the occult in the group too. Obviously Christians, ex-Christians, New Agers, these sannyasins. There's quite a broad spectrum. I mean, he manages to appeal to a fairly broad spectrum of people, and my sense is that one probably wouldn't learn that much by looking at people's superficial beliefs so much as their childhoods and their family backgrounds and their early experiences of trauma. I think that's probably the hidden dynamic in any cult. People are attracted to a charismatic leader. I put this on the back of the book, I shortened it, but that you know, we look for the leader or the mentor or the father or the mother figure whose teeth fit our wounds.
Right. And you mentioned that often, like the father figure, as John Deruder as a father figure.
Yeah,
it's interesting. And I mean, you've been in contact face-to-face, talked to him, you know, I mean, not in great detail, but definitely, you know, I think that you were talking to him in Edmonton.
I don't remember. As a supplicant, though. Like, I've never had a real conversation with what I would consider a real, you know, an ordinary personal man-to-man conversation with John. I don't think anyone has.
Interesting. And that was another thing, how distant he was from his followers. That was another kind of theme in your book, is who knows the real John? Even his first wife kind of asked that question. Who is this person, you know?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and isn't it interesting that people, including myself for a time, can somehow rule out the testimony and the experience of somebody who is married to the guy as irrelevant, you know, as compared to the thralls who just sit at his feet and think he's God. Somehow their testimonies are considered real and in truth, whereas somebody who feels that they were betrayed by him and really saw what he's like just on an everyday living basis, that testimony is considered irrelevant.
Interesting. You mentioned the calling earlier. Can you just tell the audience or the listeners what the calling was?
Right. So the calling, I'm pretty sure that John was using the term the calling long before it took on the designation it has now. But currently the calling has become John speak for he can have sex with as many of his followers as he wants in secret. Regardless of the effect that it has on them, if they melt down, if they feel suicidal, if it ruins their lives, that all of that is irrelevant, because he is responding to what he calls the calling, which is, well, you know, your guess is as good as mine, really. Well, I suppose mine's a bit better because I've read, you know, I've gone more deeply into it, so I know the rationale behind it. But essentially it's what it sounds like. He's being moved by God to do these things. It's kind of the oldest excuse in the book.
Right. I mean, and you actually kind of attribute that he might even be involved in some kind of weird tantric energy occult behavior with these sexual relationships with women, right? Didn't you say that there was like maybe he's involved in tantric stuff? Does that sound
well,
right?
Well, he's denied tantric, but that's because John doesn't want to be reduced to anything, you know, profane. Even tantra would be considered profane, because he considers himself, I would say, if he does believe his own hype, to be the living incarnation of Christ, God, truth, all in one. So, you know, he's a law unto himself. But in terms of whether what he's doing has an occult dimension, well, that's John's claim. Yeah. And he's saying it's changing these women's brains.
Right.
He's certainly saying that he's moving from the deepest part of being into the deepest part of their being. So that's certainly hidden. It's certainly energetic. And it also seems to be what his victims, if I can call them that, that they wouldn't all identify as that by any means. There's, I presume, plenty of women who feel that, you know, they're consensual and that they're getting some benefit from it, but those ones aren't speaking to me. So right. I've spoken to at least one who felt that she was traumatized by the encounter with him, and that it led to a breakdown and suicidal ideation, and that she was completely shut out by him. He wouldn't even answer her emails afterwards. And she feels that he was mining her sexuality, in a certain sense, that somehow he was infiltrating her innermost space by imposing his sexuality on her in order to mine it and then use it for his own ends. She even thinks that the way that he's able to manifest power and light and wisdom, whatever we're going to call it, on stage, is via this mining process, that he mines people's essence and then he recycles it into his own product.
It sounds like, it reminds me of this thing Hubbard used to do to women, you know, is like have sex with them, but they would be in total fear and terror. It'd be a horrible experience for them. And, you know, they remain cracked by it, and, you know, it's supposed to be some kind of old ritual thing. I don't know if De Ruyter goes that deep, but he's used terms like alchemy, which, you know, is a very non-Christian term. He uses that in his explanations for his people who are listening to him, whatever, the alchemy of being or some stuff like that. So he definitely has elements of the secret knowledge. He also, like you talked about, there being a secret core group in there. He made early statements that he was one of the two witnesses in the Book of Revelation, which is a very bold statement that a lot of Christians would scoff at, but because there's a tie-in with those two in Jerusalem, if I remember correctly, if I remember my eschatology correctly. But he makes some very bold statements. I'm the Messiah, I'm the Christ, blah, blah, blah. You know, he doesn't act like it, but that's what he states. But I find it very interesting. He seems to know a lot of different stuff. There's also this hell-proofing, this notion. Can you talk a little bit about hell-proofing?
Not much, because it's just a phrase I heard towards the end of writing this book, and I'm not there in Edmonton. I didn't get very much from the horse's mouth, so to speak. But it seems to have more than one meaning also, because there are, I'll have to say, rumours, although I think they're more than rumours. There's testimonies, allegations that John DeRuta is doing something called wilderness training, which is taking people out into the wilderness in order to learn hunting skills and other who knows what for the coming collapse of civilization. So that could be a kind of hell-proofing in a very sort of practical way. I think the more general meaning is, and it's probably consistent actually with DeRuta's teachings throughout his entire ministry, but it has to do with putting people through extreme discomfort so that they will become immune to it. I mean, again, this is quite a good example of something that intersects with beliefs that I had before I met John, and to some extent that I still have, which is that in order to grow as individuals, we do need to leave our comfort zones. We can't just stay safe and complacent. We do need to test ourselves and stretch ourselves and so on. And, you know, my marriage has been a bit of a hell-proofing experience, to be honest. You know, I've been triggered and had to suffer and feel powerless and impotent and useless and all kinds of things. Most people who've been in a long marriage will know what I'm talking about. It does stretch us. And it does allow us to develop patience and compassion and serenity and you know, virtues through the process of suffering, not as a direct result of it, but it's inseparable from the discomfort, right? So all well and good, but John's thing does seem to take it over the line, which is almost like a Christian thing of ascetics. Like, the more you suffer, the more you'll be doing penance, the more you will be showing your loyalty to truth, and the more you will be, you could say killing a part of you that that makes you suffer, but also that is unclean. Like, it's a sort of purging thing. That if he can persuade people to submit to all kinds of indignities, humiliations, discomforts, because he says so, then they're going to be forced to let go of the parts in themselves that do have wants and needs, which are considered a no-no in John DeRuta's philosophy, you know, that does have self-interest, that those parts are just going to get burned away in the fire of what they believe is truth. But I would say it's probably more like a military kind of thing of being indoctrinated through a kind of abuse, really subtle abuse.
I mean, and that's kind of the dynamic that takes place between DeRuta and his followers, right? There's a kind of subtle abusiveness, and it's traced back, you traced it back from the beginning, where he kind of like guilt trips on people,
yeah,
stuff like that. It seems like that type of dynamic is taking place even till today. You write about the accountability committee, where, you know, people are going to be put to account, but it's going to be done by a star chamber and nobody's going to know what's going on. It seems on the topically it seems benign, but you know, you don't want to fall under the—
Well, it's unclear what the accountability committee is actually in terms of what it means, because I think it's supposed to be a committee that holds John accountable in a certain sense, as in where I think it came about when the Benita von Sass affidavits came out, and you read excerpts from that. So she claimed, I mean, she claimed all kinds of things that were very, obviously very damning about John DeRuyter, including that he claimed to be Christ battling Satan, and that in order to do battle with Satan internally, he had to go against his own teachings and commit all, devious sexuality and all kinds of sinful behavior. I mean, very left-hand path sort of stuff, right?
It's Sabbatean. It's like Sabbatean. Levy, or what are those guys? I can't remember the names. Or two of them. Frank and Levy.
Sabbatai Zvi.
Zvi.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely, and it's coming more to light, this kind of philosophy, and how it does seem to be underlying our culture in many ways, or the power structures. But anyway, back to the Accountability Committee. I think the idea was that it came about there to address people's concerns about what John was doing and what was coming to light. So in a certain sense, it was supposed to be a way for John to mediate with his followers through this committee, i.e. if you had issue with what John was doing, you could go to the committee and say, I don't understand what John's doing, and I'm feeling distrust and I'm feeling doubt, and then they would pass on John's explanations or what have you. So you can see how clever that could be for a cult, because it seems to be providing a service for people who are wrestling with doubts and all the rest of it. But it's also a way to keep tabs on them, to find out who is having doubt, and to bring them back into the fold.
Right. Good point. Did you ever hear of anything of them keeping folders on followers, kind of like Scientology, where they keep tabs on people?
I haven't heard anything about that. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
Because it seemed like what was her name? Von Saas, Benita Von Saas seemed to be on top of things before she was kind of forced out. I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of knew where the followers were or knew where he was making his money.
Yeah, unfortunately that wasn't something I could get into, because there was no way to, there was nobody to ask, and Benita Von Saas wasn't talking to me. But I do get the sense with Oasis, as with most things, that you can somewhat extrapolate what's going on behind the scenes by what you can see. So several people have said that the people in the inner circle, the people who've been with John the longest, who are supposedly the closest to him, are the most closed-minded, the most rigid, the most intolerant, the most controlling people in the group. And certainly there's a lot of evidence that that's the way the organization works. It works like any other corporation, in this kind of ruthless, you could say psychopathic, because that's, they've made the correlation between corporations and psychopaths, pure self-interest.
I mean, I think that the Oasis is incorporated in some. I mean, it is a business, right?
It's a corporation, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a corporation, so it's there, and it's a moneymaker. I think he charges $10 for every lecture, gets 300 people a lecture. That's $3,000 a lecture. I think he does it twice a day, right? Guy's making $6,000 a pop, flies around first class.
Yeah,
Hanks has a monster truck. He has all of the elements of wealth, $1 million house, I think, if I remember everything. So it's not hurting.
No, and so what I was getting at was that it wouldn't surprise me if Oasis was functioning not only as a corporation but also as a kind of information gathering agency, or much like an intelligence agency operates, just within its own sphere, right. Which is what we would expect from a cult.
Right. I mean, that's Scientology, that's Osho, right? I mean, all that stuff, they had intelligence arms and stuff like that. So it wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. I mean, one doesn't want to speculate too much, and I didn't in the book, but on the other hand, one doesn't want to continue being naive about it. And the more I've uncovered about John, the more becomes possible.
Right, and you ask the book is lots of questions are taking place, lots of questions to try to get answers. So that was one of the elements of the book that I appreciated, was you really were trying to do some analysis, try to figure out, what was going on, what DeRuyter's intentions were, his character. I mean, you lay it out very well. It's a really well-done book, so I highly recommend the book. We've come to about an hour. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or anything you'd like to advise the listeners?
I'm not one for giving advice, or at least not just out of the blue like that, not without a context. It depends, because one of the things about Dark Oasis is, I'm curious about who the book is going to appeal to, who it's going to be useful or helpful to, and who it's going to be just interesting to. Because, obviously there are the people who've left John, that's the obvious audience, that's pretty small. Then there's the people who follow John. They've obviously been advised to go nowhere near it, even if they know about it. They know that it's coming out. They may not know that it has come out, but they're going to be afraid to even, look at the cover, never mind read the damn thing. But then there's people like yourself who are interested just generally in the mechanics of cult and of mind control.
Yes.
And I think that that's...
I think that's your broadest audience right there.
Well, it's obviously the biggest, yeah, but I think in the same way is what makes the story relevant, far beyond the specifics of John DeRuta. Making him a case study, but also myself.
You have a first-person account. I think that's very valuable. You've talked to people face-to-face. You've met John DeRuta. You talked to his ex-wife. You have... This is a valuable book in regards to cult studies,
People who I was a follower also.
Right,
what I've attempted there is probably, there aren't many books like this, is a combination of an analysis of cult mechanics and a specific leader with a first person testimony from somebody who fell prey to that. It just makes more sense to me to investigate stuff that's close to home. Obviously, the case of John DeRuta, I was trying to work something out for very personal reasons. I didn't set out to write a book about cults that might help people understand the phenomenon. I set out to extricate myself from a cult that I'd stumbled into. And, of course, the first lesson of that is don't assume that you're immune to that kind of mentality, and don't think that you would know it if you ended up in a cult, because nobody does, right?
Nobody does, right? No, none of those people did. Nobody thinks they're in a cult. They don't see the barriers being built up around them. I'm sure on the surface, every cult looks just like Oasis, right? Pretty clean, benevolent, beatific leader. All these people milling about, doing good works, and then they get in there and they go, holy, after a while it's exposed to them, right?
Yeah.
All that stuff is kept secret. So it's the same thing with Scientology, same thing with the Moonies, they don't see the inner core of the crazy, ideology. The same thing with Mormonism, all that stuff. Have you read the early Mormon affidavits?
No.
Yeah, they're great. I'll send you the text. It sounds like something just out of like what Benita von Sass wrote. All this inside information, how much of a scoundrel Joseph Smith was, how he was, trying to make money, digging for gold, and using all these weird rods and dowsing rods and all this stuff. It's amazing. If the Mormons would have read that before they, none of those people probably would have read more, become Mormons, because they didn't hear that. So your book will serve that service. Okay. Here's a critical insight into, John DeRuta.
Yeah, well, hopefully. That probably would be the optimal target audience would be people who are just discovering John and think that they found God on legs, as so many people did believe. And forewarned is potentially forearmed. And, of course, the thing that we don't mention here is a cult isn't the leader, the cult is the followers.
Well, that's a good point. I think you make that point, the dynamic between the followers and the leader and how they work against, with each other, right? It's the same. I analogized it to like a therapist and somebody needing therapy, where they're constantly going back and there's no intention to leave, right? So the therapist never wants his money to ever go anywhere, and the other person wants solutions, right? Constantly to go back and talk about their problems. Mm-hmm. And I kind of saw that as that kind of dynamic between DeRuta and his followers.
Yeah, well, ironically, I first spotted that in myself before I spotted it in DeRuta, because I was running this online group, and if you heard about it because I didn't really write about it in the book, but it was the Stormy Weather Existential Detective Agency. Did you ever hear about that?
No. How long are you? Is it current?
No, it's not. I was running it with my wife to begin with, and then on my own from about 2009 to about 2 years anyway, 2009, 2010, and it was the tagline was pattern recognition, identity deconstruction. It was this online group that would explore their own daily lives and mundane stuff, and then kind of follow clues, correspondences and whatnot, dreams, and to try and map the kind of identity patterns that we were all trapped in, and get to the truth of ourselves. And it was quite effective for a time, but one of the things that sabotaged it was that I was so into John that I was sharing audios with the group, I was quoting John, I was basically encouraging people to listen to the audios and listen to John, and I was emulating John's way of talking more and more, even his vocal rhythms. I let myself get possessed by my charismatic leader, and I didn't start to question that to begin with, but what I did start to question was my own, what you were just talking about with therapists, that I began to notice that I was very possessive of the members of my group. I didn't like it when any of them left, and I always guilted them, and it was like, it's not ready, you're not time, and I basically used all of my skills as a psychoanalyst, if you will, to guilt them and prevent them from leaving. And I started to notice that. I said, well, wait a minute, this can't be right. So this is like some sort of power trip that I'm unconsciously on here, that I'm getting such a high from helping people and guiding people and being in the role of the leader, guru, psychoanalyst guy, that I'm making these people my prisoners.
Well, isn't that it? I mean, look at through history, the lure of being a prophet or a guru is strong in probably all cultures. Whether it's the witch doctor, whether it's the shaman, right, which you're familiar with, all these other roles that people who may not be in it for the best of intentions love that role, right? Power, mm-hmm. authority, ability to shape reality. Yeah. That was your intro from Philip Dick, right?
Yeah, control people's perceptions of reality.
The greatest power one human being can exert over others is to control their perceptions of reality. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that through history, that's it.
Yeah, well, I think, back to this point about how it's the followers who create the cult, it's also the followers that create the leader, essentially. I mean, the way we tend to look at it is the opposite. The leader brainwashes the people and turns them into cult members, and so it's all on the leader. Well, but that's the attitude of the cult followers that makes the cult possible. Right. At the same time, as in the leader is doing everything. And
it's an excellent point. It's a symbiosis, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely.
He adjusts his words to the crowd. The crowd says something. He tries to solve their pain or problems or trauma that everybody has.
Yeah. And I'm sure that's a big part of the justification of cult leaders or whatever else we're going to call them. False ceremony masters is the term that I use. They can tell themselves they're responding to people's needs, and it's not, What can they do? If this is what people want me to do, this is what I will be.
Right.
So then I think we're getting to the question of, is there a benevolent kind of leader? Is it possible to lead, really, without taking people out of their center and their autonomy, without stripping people of autonomy?
It's a great question. I mean, can you make an example of that? I mean, is there an example of somebody who's just let people be themselves or whatever?
Well, I mean, there's the cliche. I can't think of a human example, no, but there's the, in terms of the principle, there's this idea of distinguishing between people who lead simply by moving forward visibly and people who lead by instruction. So it's the difference between leading by example and leading by command, right? somebody who leads by example simply does stuff and inspires others to do it, and I would say doesn't really care if anybody's following. He might not even notice because his eyes are focused on where he's going, as compared to a false leader, their eyes are focused on the followers because the followers make them feel like they're leaders. So then those guys aren't going anywhere. Ironically, they instill this idea that they're leading because they're giving people a sense of purpose. But people's sense of purpose is just to follow this guy, you know? It's sort of circular.
We poured our blood into the field and left with nothing but the air. We could not eat your promises and starve to death while now. I disappear. I am hell like blood is hell. This is the place where Jesus fell. And you're follow. Arise, arise, your work is done. The fields are buried with the dead. How sweet it looks like no. His messages in shadows hid. Don't waste.